We'll do, we had an overview last year from the Metropolitan Council, but I've asked them to come back today to go more in depth on their current activities and future plans in the area of housing. We've seen a period of huge escalation in housing values through the 90s into the early 2000s, followed by a period of sharp decline over the last few years. Coupled with credit issues that have significantly impacted people across the country, we stand today facing both opportunity and challenge. So a wise choice of approach could lead to more positive outcomes, while a poor approach could leave us with some very serious trouble ahead. I understand we have our chairperson, Haig, here with us today. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for coming in. And I know Mr. Shetland will take over when you have to leave early, so we're glad to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we up live? Oh, yep. Great. Good work, Judd. Thank you for inviting us here to talk a little bit about our role in affordable housing and in housing in general at the council, and a little bit about my vision for housing and why this is important for us as a region. I first wanted to say before I got started, though, that I think you'd enjoy that I began my public service career as the committee assistant for the Senate Local Government Committee in the 70s, so many, many years ago. So it's fun to be back in front of the Local Government Committee. And it's an area of interest of mine and has been for a long time, because I really believe that local government is where our citizens have the chance to really interact with their local government leaders. And I think that's particularly true for the mayors and the city council members in our cities in the metropolitan region. So I want to tell you a little bit about my interest in housing and why I think that this is such an important topic, and so I'm glad you're spending the time on it. Some of you may know that in addition to my role as the chair of the Met Council, I lead Habitat for Humanity in the Twin Cities, and I have done that for the last 7 years. So I've had the chance to both be an affordable housing developer myself and build housing for very low-income families and partners with them and with the community. And I've worked in over 50 cities in the 7 metro county area doing that work. So I have kind of a feet on the street approach to housing as a result of that work. And what I know from my work at both Habitat and at the Met Council, that stable, safe housing is really a foundation for a family to be healthy, for kids to succeed at school, for strong, safe, stable neighborhoods. So I think it's really important to both the quality of life, our economic vitality as a region. And so creating a housing policy plan for the region will be some of the work that we are going to embark on this next year at the Metropolitan Council. I believe that we as a region compete with regions around the country. Our competitors are some of the great urban regions in a global economy, and that housing is a critical component to provide a place where people can afford to live, where they can get to work, where they have access to good quality schools, and it has a lot to do with livability and the quality of life in the region. So thanks to the foresight of people who created this Metropolitan Council way back in the 1960s, who had this vision about how do we bring all these local governments together and how do we have a real vision for the region. That's our work as a planning organization, is to bring a lot of different voices together to create a consistent strategy for the region. And we're embarking on this process now. We're going to be creating our regional development framework, which is sort of like the big strategic plan for the Twin Cities metropolitan region that will go out to 2040. And this year is a big year of input, public hearing, working with our stakeholders to do that. But one of the areas that is important is housing in all of its aspects. It is, I think, particularly critical. The chair talked about how the housing economy has changed so much in the last 3 to 4 years. And for us to begin to think now about how the region will be positioned with what we think will be some pretty big shifts in how housing is going to get built and what market demand will be is part of why we want to do a housing policy plan. What we do know is that we're entering a time at which there are big changes going on in housing demand. The baby boomers are aging. Their children are growing up and trying to get into the housing market. And the type of housing that people are going to want in the future is probably going to be different than what they wanted 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So part of a housing policy plan work that we want to do is really make sure we're capturing good information about that so we can provide resources to all of the communities that are will create goals for housing within their local comprehensive plans in their own communities. I was in a meeting this morning and heard from a national spokesperson that, according to a survey done by the National Association of Realtors, that 56% of people said they want smaller houses on smaller lots with access to transportation, local services, and so different types of communities going forward. So that was a pretty interesting piece of information. So I know on the affordability side of housing that the need is very great. There are still thousands of people in our region who do not have safe, stable housing to live in. I know that local communities want to meet these goals, and they need tools to be able to meet those goals and respond to that need. And so part of the work of a housing policy plan is to help us get there and understand what are the tools that local governments need and how can we create more opportunity for everyone to succeed and to have a safe, stable place to call home. And that we do in partnership with our local governments and our cities. So it's very much of a collaborative approach to this work. But I'm going to quickly shift to, so what has the Met Council done in the housing field for the past number of years? And we have four distinct areas that we work in. And I'm going to turn it over to Guy Peterson, who is our Director of Community Development, who actually manages this work on a day-to-day basis. But there are really four things that we're going to go into more detail on. The first is the Metro HRA. That's a Housing and Redevelopment Authority for the metropolitan area. We're going to talk about the Metropolitan Land Planning Act, because we have a responsibility, and local communities do, to plan for housing within their communities. And we want that housing to be consistent and make sense across the region. And then we have the Livable Communities Act, which provides certain incentives to develop and to create more affordable housing. And then the last thing that Guy will talk about is the process for creating a new housing policy plan, and I tried to share with you some of what I think will be in that housing policy plan as we develop that. So with that, I want to turn that over to Guy. But before I do, I kind of hesitate to ask questions because he's really got all the detailed answers. But if there's anything I could answer just right off the top before I turn it over to Guy, I'd be happy to do that because I'm going to need to leave to go back to a meeting at the Met Council.
Hey, do we have any questions for Chair Hick? Senator Keeler.
Just a quick question, and that has to do with the changes in the value of housing and what it's done to the affordable housing. I represent Richfield, which has the value of the homes have gone down, and we have these percentages of affordable housing, and one of the things that they're concerned about is that they now have more affordable housing, and yet the Met Council is looking to have more in it. And I know that's just an example of other communities around. Could you just talk about
Absolutely.
The amount of affordable housing Met Council is looking to require a community to have, or where the maximum amount of that would be?
Sure. Let me talk both generally, and then I'll let Guy do some more of the specifics. But in general, what we do know is that as we think about planning for the future, about 75% of the housing that we need is already built. And in many communities, we need reinvestment and preservation of existing affordable housing, and we need to make sure that is affordable as well. So strategies that provide for investment and retooling, reinvesting in existing housing stock, I think will be very important as we go forward. Because values have dropped, does not necessarily mean that housing is affordable to more people. Before the drop in the housing market, there were literally probably 50,000 people earning less than 50% of the area median income who needed to live in state safe, affordable housing. So the economic changes have not made it possible for everyone to meet that need. The process in the housing policy plan going forward will be looking at the goals that get set for local communities, taking the new forecasts about economic growth and about development. So that's part of the process that we'll be in.
Senator Kielich mentioned the amount of affordable housing that you'd be required to have. Was that your?
There are certain policies that the Met Council wants cities to have X number of percentage or whatever.
Right.
And one of the concerns of some of the cities is that they have more affordable property, so you can build more housing in them. But then that can tend to concentrate that affordable housing in one community or another. And there's a certain fairness there where those communities that have prosperous real estate get to avoid having any affordable housing in their community. And so you end up with this constant concentration that, you know, it upsets the homeowners that are having that housing required or encouraged or, you know, funded or whatever in their community rather than going to some place that has not done their fair share of affordable housing in the metro area and stepped up to the plate and be able to do something there. So that was my concern, is that, you know, that we're making sure that if we're doing this, we're spreading it out through the entire community and not just those places that tend to be already in lower property values. So.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciated your comments, Senator Kielich. That's kind of the same direction that I was heading. Madam Chair, I represent Brooklyn Park, and I know in my area in particular, we have a ton of affordable housing right now that is not being occupied, townhomes that are selling for $30,000, extremely affordable. So I guess my question to you is, first, I was very interested in what you said about that need and how that need is so great and where you're coming up with those numbers, and is there any way that we could put actual tangible numbers to that need?
Senator and Mr. Chair, thank you.
Could you state your name for the team? They've been asking me three or four times.
For my name?
Yeah, for the team.
It's Haig. Sue Haig.
Thank you very much.
Part of the work that we want to do in the housing policy plan is really have a chance to look at some of those numbers, because a lot of the data that we have, those are based on, came from after the last census, and we know that our community has changed a great deal. So part of what we hope to do as we create the new development framework and a new housing policy plan is get better data for all local governments and for the region. I certainly, you know, share your belief that there are many areas that do have a higher percentage of affordability within their communities than others.
And Mr. Chair and Chair Haig, you know, I was also really struck, and I thank you for that answer. I was also really struck by the comment that, you know, Senator Kielich made about prompting communities to have more affordable housing. I would love to hear from you specifically, A, your thoughts on where the council fits in that, what their authority is right now, and the means to exercise that authority.
Chair Haig.
Senator and Mr. Chair, philosophically, where I stand is I believe that local governments are our partners in this work, and that we create opportunity providing incentives for that to be created. And that, I think, is the best and strongest way to approach this work. That's really what the Livable Communities Act does. It provides incentives for communities to create more affordable housing. That's the biggest financial resource that we have to do that, and I think that makes good sense. With that, you know, I would hope that every community would look at their local comprehensive plans and see what they can do to make sure that people from a range of incomes can live in their community, because it is the people who work as, you know, nurse's aides, school bus drivers, factory workers, service workers who live in all of our communities. And they would need the access to those jobs throughout the region. So the issue of looking at job availability and its connection to housing is something I think that we'll need to look at in a housing policy plan.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Hagg. When you analyze those 10-year comp plans, correct me if I'm wrong, but specifically, don't those have to do with transit and sewer and different things like that?
Chair Hagg.
Senator and Mr. Chair, yes, they do, and they also have a housing component in them.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Chair Hagg, could you explain that component to me? I guess that's where I'm kind of getting lost here as to how – because what I would – and maybe this will help. I'm trying to understand why there is a need for a policy if you already have the authority there to do it, and I'm just trying to make that link between the two.
Senator, Mr. Chair, and Guy will get into more depth on the Metropolitan Land Planning Act, but it is that state law that requires local communities to have a housing component of their local comprehensive plan. And so when we put together a regional plan, we want to make sure that the goals for the region make sense as a whole and are achieving kind of regional goals and are balanced with what the unique differences are from one local to the next, because of course there are many of those throughout the region. So the housing policy plan is really going to gather some of that data that you referred to that we is very, very old, we have not done for quite a long time, so that we all have better information to plan and develop our communities.
Thank you. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Hagg. You know, I heard you say that the majority of people, you believe, want smaller houses on smaller acreages or land, and that I'm wondering, do our housing policies then need to require that, or will the market drive that? Because if nobody wants bigger houses, they'll have to quit building them because they won't sell them. So do we need policies to get to that, because if it's going to be consumer-driven, will we need policies?
Chair Hagg.
Mr. Chair and Senator, local comprehensive plans really do set forth the policies for how housing gets developed within our local communities. That's what a local comprehensive plan is. And they may, maybe unintentionally, drive the market toward larger lots and larger homes by what they say in those plans, or they may provide incentives for smaller lots and smaller units, less costly units. So I think there are a lot of issues in local comprehensive plans that have to do that influence the market, but I would agree with you that market will be a big driver, but there's a lot of public investment component to market as well.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Guy because actually he can really probably answer almost all of these questions, and we'll go through all four of these areas for you. So thank you very much for having me and having the council talk about housing today.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Guy Peterson. I'm the Community Development Division Director at the Metropolitan Council. And as Chair Hagg says, I'm going to speak to these four issue areas and areas of work of the council that touches affordable housing. The first of which is to give you an overview of our Metro HRA. The Metropolitan Council Housing and Redevelopment Authority, created by the Minnesota Legislature, it was created by the Minnesota Legislature in 1974. And at that time, in the mid-70s, the main driver of this legislation to have the council become an HRA and have that authority was because of the federal Section 8 Rent Assistance Program, which had just been initiated, the major federal program to provide rental assistance to low and moderate income households. And the legislature felt that there were going to be many small communities that would not be situated such that they could administer such a program with the staffing, the unavailability of staffing to do that. And so they felt that it would make sense to have one entity be able to do that administration of rental assistance programs for a group of suburban communities. And so that was the major opportunity at that time and why it was created. This single entity would obviously bring economies of scale and cost efficiencies in being able to serve more than one community.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Would that be Section 8 as we know it? Or what was the federal rental program, rent assistance program?
It gave us the authority that Metro HRA to do rental assistance programs, but yes, the Section 8 rent assistance program was the major impetus because, as I said, it was happening concurrently at the federal level, and the legislature wanted communities in the metropolitan area to be able to access and provide those rental subsidies in their communities to their residents, but was concerned that there wouldn't be a vehicle for them to do that easily. That's why they created the Metro HRA. So the Metro HRA operates and oversees 8 rental assistance programs serving roughly 100 communities in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Nearly 7,000 rental units are assisted through the Metro HRA's program, and these subsidies bring in $50 million annually directly to owners of rental property, of which currently we have about 2,000 active landlords for the tenants that receive assistance through the Metro HRA. 6 of the rental programs are federally funded programs, the biggest one, of course, being the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program with more than 6,000 recipients of that program. But there are several other smaller programs that are targeted to special populations of need, such as adults with handicaps or handicapped and homeless people are also assisted by some of these individual programs. And in addition, we administer 2 rental assistance programs funded by the state through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, the Bridges Program, and the Rental Assistance for Anoka County programs.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that the federal programs require that we not issue vouchers to folks unless they're citizens of the U.S. Is that an accurate statement?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, yes.
How do you confirm an applicant's citizenship?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, I could ask Beth Reitz to come up and join. She can probably fill in, and I don't know all the details of that process.
Mr. Chair, Senator, my name is Beth Reitz. I'm the Council's Director of Housing and Livable Communities, and the federal government has a very sophisticated system whereby electronically we are able to confirm the eligibility status before applicants and participants are made eligible for the program.
Senator Peters.
Is that the E-Verify program?
Yes, it is.
Okay. The follow-up question I have is, we're having this discussion in St. Cloud right now at our own HRA. Does the state-funded programs have the same requirement for citizenship that the federal programs do?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe they do, but I can get that answer for you.
Thank you. I would be interested in that because our own staff in St. Cloud is having the same difficulty that you are, I think, in identifying that. So I would appreciate a chance to hear back on that when you get a chance.
Absolutely.
Senator Kalish.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just curious if you could explain or describe the relationship between the public housing authorities and
MRA.
Yeah, the HRA. I'm sorry. I just But because we've got the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority and others, and so, you know, how does that, are you working with them? Are they, you know, are they just coordinating the efforts?
Mr. Chair,
does that work? So.
Senator, as this slide indicates, there are 11 housing authorities in our metropolitan area that administer the Section 8 program, for example. And we administer in all of the areas that are in yellow on that map, which is Carver, Anoka, and suburban Hennepin and Ramsey counties, with the exclusion of a few cities in Hennepin County. And we are the largest provider of the Section 8 program in the state of Minnesota. So those other entities administer their own Section 8 program and have their own allocation of vouchers.
Are they coordinated efforts so that you're working if you've got a unit available, for example, in Minneapolis has somebody that needs a unit, do you? Is that information?
Yes, there's a process that allows the sharing of information and availability of units, that type of thing.
Just so we have kind of a regional approach to it, even though we have different entities administering them.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
A clarification on that. Did you say that the Met Council HRA oversees which programs? Was it like Carver, Dakota, Carver?
Scott. No, it was, Mr. Chair, Madam Senator, it's Carver County, Anoka County, suburban Hennepin, and suburban Ramsey County. Those are the places, and there were some cities, as you can see from the map, some cities in suburban Hennepin County that administer their own program.
And Mr. Chair, and the rest of the counties then.
And then the other entities administer their own. Yes. So as I indicated earlier, 7,000 households in our Metro HRA program. This is essentially 18,000 people that are safely and adequately housed through this program, including 9,500 children. The average family size is 2.5 persons. The average income is $14,400 per year, so they are very low-income households. About 48% of those assisted or disabled are elderly. Individuals and families constitute about 52% of those receiving assistance, but I'd point out that 98% of the 52% are families. We had our waiting list open. Waiting list issues are always a major issue in terms of the supply of affordable housing and supply of vouchers that are available to assist households. We opened our waiting list in 2007. In a four-day period of time, we received 25,000 applications.
Excuse me, Mr. Peterson, when you say affordable housing, do you mean subsidized housing?
Mr. Chair, yes. Section 8. For the Section 8 program. Over 25,000 people filled out applications. We used a lottery system to put that down to a manageable list because there would be no way we could have a waiting list with 25,000 people on it. So we brought that down to a list of 5,000 folks on the waiting list. 5 years later, we still have 2,600 of those families that are on that same waiting list that was created. So it takes a long time to reach people. The demand far outstrips the ability to assist these folks on the Section 8 program.
Senator Roman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the meantime, what are these people doing? Are they people who have been living with other relatives, perhaps, and they want their own place? Or what are they doing if they can't get into the program?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's probably a part of it. Yes, they're sharing housing, or they're just paying more than 30 or 40 or 50% of their income for their rent. So they're very burdened in terms of their housing costs.
So, Mr. Peterson, is it the housing, the number of houses that's short, or the number of houses willing to take Section 8 that are short that's causing this list, or a shortage in funding for the actual Section 8?
Mr. Chair, it's the shortage of subsidies from the federal government to help. We only have enough subsidies to help at this time 7,000 households, and the costs of rents are going up, therefore reducing, you know, the number of households that we can assist each year. So that's the challenge. And then there's more folks that would be seeking this kind of rental assistance that we just can't assist. We can't
Mr.
get
Peterson,
to them.
What is the average subsidy per person selected to be in the program?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Beth to answer that.
Mr. Chair, the average subsidy across all family sizes is approximately $650 per month.
Thank you. Please continue. Senator Nelson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question on the waiting list and on eligibility. What are the income guidelines? Did you mention that? I might have missed that. The income guidelines as far as who is eligible? Is it a certain percent of the federal poverty guidelines? And if so, what is that? How do you determine whose income makes them eligible for this housing?
Mr. Chair, again, if I could ask Ms. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the 75% of all families that are put onto or made eligible for the Section 8 program must be within 30% of the area median income. And then 25% can have an income as high as 50% of the area median income.
Senator Nelson.
Well, that's kind of an interesting way to determine eligibility. I'm more familiar with the programs that determine eligibility based upon a percent of federal poverty guidelines. So if we were to have Section 8 housing in, I don't know, let's say Edina, that would be totally different than having housing in a different part of the state. Am I understanding that right?
Ms. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there are indeed actual income limits per family size. And there is a HUD establishes area median income for the entire region, and it is one amount. For instance, it's a little over $80,000 for a family of four. That's area median income. And then the percentage, in other words, HUD describes extremely low income, which are the families that are eligible for the Section 8 program, as being equal to 30% of the area median income. So, for instance, for a family of four, that's approximately $30,000. So you can't make more than that.
Just to follow
Senator
up.
Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So of the 25,000 interested applicants, or well, that was in 4 days, let's say the 2,600 that are still on the list, are those all eligible, income-eligible applicants?
Ms. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Senator, at the time that they applied, their income was well within the income limits.
Okay, and I just want to follow up. So this is a federal program that determines these eligibility guidelines as a percent of median income?
Okay. That's correct.
Thank you, Ms. Okay, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, was there any federal stimulus dollars that you received a couple years back that helped with any of either the issues on the number of people on the wait list or the housing units that were available?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, no.
Okay, continue, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving then on to the Metropolitan Land Planning Act, which is the second and a major area of which the Metropolitan Council touches the issue of housing and affordable housing. And this was from the Metropolitan Land Planning Act legislation that was written in 1976. And it requires the council, this law requires the council to give guidance and direction to local governments in preparing their comprehensive plans.
Mr. Peterson, can I just ask you?
Yes, Mr.
What does direction mean? Does that mean you tell them to do it, or it's a suggestion, or?
Mr. Chair, the law says that the comprehensive plans will do this, and that it says the council will give guidance guidance and direction in terms of the handbooks and the materials that we produce to assist communities in preparing the document to assist them.
What happens if a community fails to take your guidance and direction?
Mr. Chair, with regard to housing, our review would indicate that they had not they had not fulfilled the requirements of the law, if in fact they didn't fulfill the requirements of the statute, which are I'm going to speak to them.
Mr. Peterson, then what would happen to them then? What would occur at that if they weren't doing that? What's the carrot or stick part of the
program? Mr. Chair, there would be, I can't put my finger right on a particular thing because there is no direct relationship to the how a community does in the housing element of its comprehensive plan. They're all written at different degrees of sophistication given the community and its staffing and its housing issues and all of those kinds of things. But there's no direct linkage to this happens to you if you don't do this with regard to a comprehensive plan. It can in other issues where policymakers make decisions and have discretion to make subjective decisions about things where that can influence their decision, but it is not a direct correlation.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And typically, if they don't develop a plan that the council approves, they get a disapproved plan and they're expected to put it in compliance. But the question that I am curious about, too, is if that continues and the city does not or the county does not get it into compliance, have you used other tools such as grant monies, extension of sewer, to force them to get into compliance, or hasn't it ever come to that? And is it possible that you could use that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, it has never come to that, and we have none of those things that you mentioned are things that are based upon how a community does with regard to its housing planning.
Okay, Mr. Peterson, continue, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So as one of these elements in terms of us giving guidance to communities is to help indicate to the communities what is their share of the region's need for low and moderate income housing. That is one of the requirements of the Land Planning Act, that each community must acknowledge its share of the region's need for low and moderate income housing. We work with the communities to determine what that amount will be in terms of an assessment that we do, a housing needs assessment. In a minute, I'll get to the numbers. But it also requires this housing element include an implementation program. So those two things are the major aspects of the requirements of the Land Planning Act with regard to housing. Now, it must include, as I said, an implementation section where the communities are to address the programs, the fiscal devices, and the official controls that they're going to use to advance and preserve affordable housing in their community. And all of the communities in preparation, in preparing their plans, the 2008 comprehensive plans that we just went through a couple years back, all of the communities satisfactorily addressed this requirement. There were no major issues with communities acknowledging their share of the region's need. And as Chair Hag had indicated, 50,000, in fact, the assessment that we had done in 2005 yielded, working with Minnesota Housing, the Family Housing Fund, other housing funders, and Metro Cities, was that we generated a number that estimated that the region would need 51,000 additional affordable housing units in the current decade.
Now, Mr. Peterson.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
This was in 2005?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And so you're requiring cities to build additional 51,000 affordable units by 2020 is your goal?
Mr. Chair, we communities put in their comprehensive plans the objectives to try to attain an additional 51,000 affordable housing units by 2020, yes.
So Mr. Peterson, that 51,000 units hasn't changed in spite of the recession and the housing bubble?
Mr. Chair, as Chair Haig indicated, we will be in a process very shortly to re-examine those numbers, engage the same kind of people to take a look at these numbers, use new forecast numbers. Let me back up to say that the factors that we looked at to determine the 51,000 affordable housing needs and how we distributed those for communities were based upon What is the amount of the forecasted growth that community is going to experience to 2020? How much affordable housing do they already have in their community? What is the proximity and availability of low-wage jobs to that community and the availability of transit service? Those are the factors that we looked at in making the distribution of that 51,000 affordable housing needs that we gave to communities, and they planned for that in their comprehensive plans.
So, Mr. Peterson, if we wanted to see a list of communities and how many they were being required to somehow get to occur in those communities, is there a list of those?
Or? Mr. Chair, yes, of course there is. We can provide it. It's on our website, but we can provide it to you.
Thank you. Mr. Keeler, Senator Keelish.
Mr. Peterson, do you know where you are on that list of 51,000 that we're committed to be built by 2020? Are we 50% there? Are we 60%?
Mr. Chair, yeah. Senator Keelish, no, we're only into the first or second year of that time frame. So we're not. It was a 2011 through 2020 time frame. So we're not very far along the continuum
Thank you.
Yet. So, Mr. Chair, then a third area of council activity in affordable housing is the Livable Communities Act. And in 1995...
Senator Nelson.
I'm so sorry. Mr. Chair. I was going to wait till the end, but I think you're moving on to a different
yes.
topic. So I really want to address my question to the topic we just were on, which was the affordable housing. And I'm still trying to understand this aspect of basing eligibility based upon the average median income of where the housing is. And you mentioned that it's based upon a statistical area. And I'm just wondering, you know, how large is that statistical area? Because I'm just thinking, you know, there are parts of the city where I would love to live, but obviously I can't afford to live in some parts of the city, so I would live in a different part of the city. So I'm just wondering, I'm assuming these statistical areas must be rather large, so they make up for differences within cities. Can you explain
Mr. Chair, that for me? The statistical area is the seven-county SMSA, the metropolitan area. That's the HUD issues, an area-wide median income for that area, and that's what we use to base our calculations on.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That's the piece of the puzzle that I was missing. I needed to hear that. Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Peterson, just one quick question before we move on. I know that here in Minnesota we're one of only two cities that has a metropolitan council style for the regional MPO, the other being Portland, Oregon. So I was wondering if you could tell us how do other major cities handle this distribution of affordable housing and comprehensive plans?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's a great variety of different ways in which they do it. Obviously, there are lots of councils of government that exist across the country. They do it in a much more attempt at collaborating. I think that the way they calculate their affordable need and their distribution is very similar. It's the issue of what are the ways, the vehicles in which they can set about to try and have those kinds of goals and fair share responsibilities actually met or worked on, because they don't have the same kind of comprehensive planning requirements necessarily that we have in our state, or the different, you know, vehicles to carry it out, the relationship that exists between the council and the Minnesota Housing to work collaboratively to meet affordable housing needs and the distribution of the dollars that they have. So I hope I'm answering your question, but there are different the methodologies to get to the needs are very similar. It's the way that they can set about to try to meet those and accomplish those and work on those that differ.
Senator Cruz.
Well, just a couple of quick follow-up questions, Mr. Chair and Mr. Peterson. I'm curious, do you know right off the top of your head how many full-time employees are dedicated to the implementation of these specific programs?
Mr. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, yes, I can tell you within the Metro HRA has approximately 35 employees. We have about half a dozen staff that work on implementing the Land Planning Act, which, of course, is far more than just the housing activities. That it's all of the comprehensive plan process and the review of all of those. I'm getting into the Livable Communities Act portion of the presentation. We have four or five staff that work on that. So those are the staff people who's.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, Judd Shetton, I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. When we talk about the HRA program, I think it's important to talk about the economies of scale that the council is able to deal with when we start talking about the HRA and the fact that the council does perform those duties. We are able to provide coverage through our HRA with that economy of scale that otherwise you'd see the individual counties or cities have to do each themselves or collaborate one way or another. So we're able to do that in a way. And again, this is federal money that's passing through the council and moving forward. So I think that's an important point to add. And you mentioned a few minutes ago about the council being the MPO, and we are the MPO that is established in order to pass federal transportation money through the council, and it really doesn't have anything to do with our housing.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. And I was just wondering, when you started, maybe when the Section 8 housing program started, was everyone in the metropolitan area in the program, and then one by one some of these entities have left? Or what happened there? Did some of them already have pre-established entities that handled housing issues?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's a variety of things. Of course, the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul have had longstanding public housing authorities to administer the federal public housing program for decades prior to the Section 8 program coming into existence. And some of the other counties may have had some entity that did, you know, housing and economic development kinds of activities, but most of it has arisen since the mid-1970s, where some of these communities got into administering the federal housing programs. Mr. Chair, they do, you know, they don't all just do a Section 8 program. They are CDAs or HRAs that do economic development, issue revenue bonds, do all kinds of different activities that are related to affordable housing and other activities.
Thank you.
All right, continue, please.
Mr. Chair, so the Livable Communities Act is really the most recent legislation involving affordable housing and the role of the Metropolitan Council. And it was a compromise incentive-based legislation passed in 1995 to allow communities to voluntarily address affordable housing needs. The Act created three funding accounts that incent local government to use funds for projects and developments that do a number of things, such as change market incentives that adversely affect the creation and preservation of living wage jobs, to include a full range of housing opportunities that mix incomes of area residents, preserve and rehabilitate affordable housing, implement compact and efficient development that intensifies land use, interrelate development and redevelopment with transit, and interrelate affordable housing and employment growth areas. The three accounts that are established in the legislation for making grants from the council are the tax-based revitalization account, which is a polluted site cleanup account, the livable communities demonstration account, and the local housing incentives account. And I'll say a little bit about each of those in a minute. There are requirements of the communities that elect to participate. They need to negotiate affordable housing goals with the Metropolitan Council, adopt a local housing action plan to guide work to achieve those goals, and have a minimum local expenditures for affordable and life cycle housing.
Senator Mr. Peterson, one of my questions, I think it has to do with the requirements that kind of concentrates the affordable housing in those closer in cities and suburbs, because obviously, the closer you get in, the more options you have for transit. There's more transit lines going through those committees. And I don't know if you could address that, because that just, once again, it, you know, if you don't have any transit or if you don't have affordable jobs further out in the the further out you go from the center of the cities, you know, could you just talk about how that works and if there's a formula that counterbalances what's there and what should be there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalash, yes, there's no question. I indicated earlier that those factors that we used in determining the affordable housing need in each community, and it is an attempt, I can't say that it's perfect, but it is an attempt to do some balancing because the factors we do look at and weight how much existing affordable housing is there already in the community, and then, you know, that's going to be for some communities that are going to have a lot of that, and so that factor is going to be a large one in this formula. Communities that don't have any, that will have the same kind of weight for them. But then you have to balance it off with these other factors about the proximity of these low-wage jobs to the communities, and obviously some of the farther out places that aren't close to employment centers, they're not going to have a large factor in this formula because we are trying to have people be connected to jobs and be close to low wage, you know, to jobs that that fit category in the distribution formula. And availability of transit, as you say, is going to be it is going to not be everywhere. It's going to be along some communities and the closer in kind of communities. And then just the forecasted growth would be, I think, another factor that would be a balancing factor because if a community is already a fully developed community, it's not going to grow a great deal, whereas the growing communities would get a larger share in that formula. So, you know, there are different factors in the formula that try to balance it off, but clearly, you know, some of them, large growing communities are going to have a larger affordable housing need numbers. And so continuing on the Livable Communities Act, Mr. Chair, 94 communities have elected to adopt housing goals in this current new 10-year span that we have we've negotiated goals with communities to continue their participation. The affordable needs that have been identified in these locally set goals are 33,200 to nearly 47,000 additional affordable units. And I put in here on the slide so you'd get a picture of what kind of income we're talking about when we say affordable units. For 2012, a family of four with an income of $50,300 would be one that would be in this category of needing affordable housing or qualifying, could pay for housing that would be considered to be affordable.
So, Mr. Peterson, will all these numbers be revised also as you relook at the plan, or?
Mr. Chair, these numbers won't be affordable housing needs will, but these won't automatically. The council would have to decide that they would want to again reexamine the numbers and again renegotiate the numbers with communities, and that's a very possible outcome. Looking at depending upon how much the numbers change when we do a new needs assessment. So it is under a separate statute. It is a different process, but we have tried to make them consistent so we don't have two different sets of objectives with communities.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You might have alluded to my question, which was then how do these income guidelines compare with the Section 8 income guidelines?
Mr. Peter.
Mr. Chair, Senator, these are higher than the Section 8. What we determined to be affordable, income that we were targeting in that needs determination was 60% of area median income.
Is that usual to have these different income guidelines? Wouldn't it make more sense to have them be consistent? I want to get to it seems to me that our housing programs there are so many of them, and they're in so many different categories, and they have so many different, like, eligibility limits like this. I understand how important it is for stable housing, but I'm a little bit concerned that the very people who most could benefit from this are maybe being turned away or not served because of the way we just have this splintered across so many categories and in so many different inconsistent manners or inconsistent guidelines. I think it's rather confusing. So maybe you could just kind of talk to
Mr. Chair, that point. Senator, it's the federal government sets those income limits on its for its particular Section 8 program, which, as Beth indicated, is to serve very low income, principally very low income housing. But it is not the entire spectrum, the entire universe of people that might have an affordable housing need, and. Like our partners at Minnesota Housing, we've worked with the precept that we should be setting 60% of area median income. That is also the maximum income limit that's permitted by the Federal Low Income Housing Tax Credit Program for new rental, affordable rental housing, and that is an income limit that is. That Minnesota Housing says is the income limit. 60% and lower are the their principal group that they assist with their housing dollars at Minnesota Housing. So,
just to follow up.
Senator Nelson.
So you're reaching different clients.
Yes.
And while it's inconsistent with the feds, it is consistent across the state, you're telling me, the 60%.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. Now, the incomes may be 60% in one community in Minnesota may be different than the 60% in our
right.
metropolitan area.
Right. Okay.
So, Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I might make one other distinction, and one is that the Section 8 program is specifically a subsidy that goes directly to an eligible household. The income limits that we use to determine affordability for the grant programs that the council has, we grant to cities to help them provide affordable housing in the marketplace. We're not talking about a direct subsidy to a direct unit. We're more so talking about helping the cities provide for housing within their communities that will help meet the needs of families at different income levels.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Peterson, you're still encouraging 125,700 new units for life cycle housing?
Mr. Chair, that's the number that the communities, the maximum number that the communities planned for in their, could be achieved in those communities given the land uses that they indicated in their local comprehensive plans submitted in 2008. So that's the high end of the range of those.
Mr. Peterson, if they were to achieve those goals, I think we'd be in some serious trouble as far as excess housing stock. I'm wondering, but you're not looking at revising, or you may look at revising these, or the communities might revise these goals as they go forward. Is that what your
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Testimony?
Yes.
Okay, continue, please.
Another distinction, Mr. Chair, that I would make is that the life cycle housing are truly different types of housing options, not necessarily affordable. Cities plan for life cycle housing with the idea that those might very well, in some instances, be higher cost units, but they provide for a different type of housing option than a single family home.
So you're encouraging cities to decide type of housing versus the market to decide that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, no, this is the communities, their land use that they put in place in their comprehensive plans call for a wide variety of potential densities of housing in their community. And what we simply did was ask the communities to plan for life cycle housing, and they indicated when we add up the totals that they put into their comprehensive plans, those are the numbers that we got.
Thank you. Continue. Please.
So, Mr. Chair, that I was indicating that the three different accounts, the tax-based revitalization account, which is that polluted site cleanup account, cleans up polluted land that has lost economic vitality. It makes land available for economic redevelopment, housing, job retention, and growth. The program so far in the 16 years that we've implemented has had funded applications for cleanups where the indications were that the projects that were funded would add or retain 37,000 jobs in the metro area and clean nearly 2,000 acres and facilitate the development of thousands of units of housing, a good share of which are affordable housing units. A second account is the Livable Communities Demonstration Account, $8 million that's available each year to support development and redevelopment projects that interrelate with transit, affordable housing and employment, and intensify land use that achieves compact development, mix housing types, values, and opportunities, and provide infrastructure, connect neighborhoods, communities, and attract investment and jobs. And so far, we've made $107 million worth of grants through this account, and the activities, if they came to fruition, would be $4 billion worth of investment, other private and public investment. And the third account is the Local Housing Incentives Account, a small account that is funded by $1 million of Council General Fund funding and a transfer of monies from the Livable Communities Demonstration Account to assist communities in creating or preserving affordable and life cycle housing to meet their goals. And we collaborate and partner with Minnesota Housing and other partners such as the Family Housing Fund to make grants and work with them through their super RFP process to make decisions and work with them in evaluating proposals for affordable housing. And through the Local Housing Incentives Account, which is specifically for the issue of affordable housing, we have participated with other funders in helping add nearly 2,700 new affordable rental units in the region, rehabilitate over 2,500 affordable rental units, rehabilitate over 900 affordable units, and leverage nearly $700 million in private and public investment. And Mr. Chair, that fourth area then is the housing policy plan that Chair Haig spoke to in
Senator
her introductory comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, this is maybe it's pretty basic, but on that last slide, the outcomes. Over how long a period of time is that, and how much money? You said leverage $700 million in private and public investment. Was that the total amount, that $700 million for this work? I'm trying to get an idea of the ROI here, the cost per unit and time period we're dealing with here. Because if we're talking 2,700 units in 20 years with $100 million, I'm just kind of looking at how that's leveraged.
Mr. Chair, Senator, first of all, it's only, I don't have the math in my head, but $1.5 million times 16 is the amount of grants that we've given. And we are only a small contributor in the development and addition of these new affordable units. They're principally funded through Minnesota Housing. The use of federal low-income housing tax credits is the primary funder of them. We would be happy to provide the senator and the committee with all of the numbers with regard to the grants in terms of the total dollars that have been granted. But all of the units that we fund meet the tests that are put in place by Minnesota Housing. They're the housing resource, the experts, the bankers, so to speak. And so they perform the financial tests on the projects that are proposed. And we, with that small account that we have, are able to just provide some additional monies to help with the long-term affordability of the units.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. Yeah, so if I understand, you don't provide the total funding to it. You add some to that that comes from the Minnesota Housing, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just one final thing, more of a comment. And what I'm getting at is obviously you don't have control over the whole project or all the dollars, but a few years back, I remember, 10 years ago, you get these horror. I just want to make sure we're not getting into these horror stories where I think it was in maybe the Neighborhood Revitalization Program in Minneapolis at the time had a deal down by the river, and they bought a couple of homes, decided to remodel them for about some enormous amount of money. I forget the exact amount, $500,000, $1 million, and the market value ended up being, somewhat well below that. But I was just trying to get a perspective. I'm not saying that's your case. I'm just trying to get a perspective on it. Thank you.
Yes.
Please continue.
So, Mr. Chair, that fourth area is the housing policy plan, the housing chapter of the Metropolitan Development Guide. State law directs the council to prepare a comprehensive development guide for the metropolitan area. The housing policy plan will guide decisions of the council regarding affordable housing and identify the region's major housing issues from a regional long-range planning perspective. And Chair Haig talked about a number of those issues and things that we want to look at and hope to examine in this policy plan work. The policy plan will contain policies and analyses aimed at addressing the region's major housing problems and to aid the council in formulating recommendations for state and federal housing legislation, as well as provide guidance for local government and the affordable housing development and financing community. The policy plan will be developed with the advice and involvement of our local and state government partners, affordable housing advocates, philanthropic interests, and others whose missions in the development, preservation, and delivery of affordable housing. So with that, Senator, that concludes my presentation. Be happy to continue to answer questions.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Peterson or okay. Senator McGuire?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. It's actually not a question on housing, but since we have the Met Council in front of us, I just have a quick question on transportation, and just maybe it's a reference question, and I could maybe ask you afterwards, but I represent Como Park area, and we are looking for transit system that actually services Como Park. So how do we get systems like that in well-traveled areas and well-visited areas? How do we get a transit system into areas like that going?
Mr. Chair, Senator McGuire, again, I'm Judd Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director at the Council. That's a great question. I would say that we do a lot of that as we put together our transportation policy plan, but even further, we would want to work with our folks at Metro Transit who do our service development, and I'm happy to have a conversation with you and those folks to discuss that. I know we've had lots of discussion around Como Park and the transit service that we have there, and we can certainly have that conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, now I understand Mayor Stevens of Woodbury is here, and Mr. Bataldon would like to address us regarding housing issues. Mayor Stevens, thank you so much for coming. Can you state your name for the tape, please?
I can. It's Mary Giuliani Stevens, and I'm the mayor of Woodbury. And also here today is Carl Bataldon, the housing specialist and associate planner for the city of Woodbury.
Thank you, Mr. Bataldon. Welcome.
Who knows
to the
a whole lot more than I do about housing, so I'm happy to have him here. Thank you for inviting us here today to talk about the Metropolitan Council housing goals for the 2011-2020 time period. Woodbury has grown a lot. We're now the 10th largest city in the state of Minnesota, and so we're really pleased to share our thoughts in this forum on housing. I think I'd like to just start out by saying I agree with Met Council Chair Sue Haig that stable, safe housing in neighborhoods are vital to our communities and the quality of life in our communities. Just a little bit of background, we continue to work and have worked with the Met Council on housing goals. I'll say that in the 1996 to 2010 time period, the last grouping for the housing goals, that Woodbury met its housing goals, affordable housing goals, of 1,584 units. Woodbury was one of only six communities in the state of Minnesota to meet those goals. The other five were Circle Pines, Norwood Young America, New Brighton, St. Paul, and Willerney. I'll also just say as an aside, since Met Council Chair Sue Haig indicated she also is president of the Habitat for Humanity, that outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul, Woodbury has the most number of Habitat for Humanity homes. Woodbury has had some concern, however, on the housing goals for this upcoming 2011-2020 time period, and this concern goes back several years. We did address it in our 2030 comp plan, so it's in there, and that plan was accepted by the Met Council. We also discussed it in a resolution passed by the Woodbury City Council in, I think it was August of 2010. And then we addressed it most recently in a letter to the Met Council in February of this year. Both in the comp plan and in the resolution, we basically accepted the housing goals that were there on the condition that we viewed them as really interim numbers and that we understood that they would be revised when new growth projections came out. We also had some concern, and you talked a little bit today about the methodology and the 60% and 80%, and so we have had and have had expressed concern about that methodology used by the Met Council. So I'm just going to briefly talk about the methodology, the actual housing numbers, and then development that's happening in the city of Woodbury. So prior to 2011, the Met Council considered a home affordable, a new home, based on a household earning of 80% of the AMI. As I just said, Woodbury was one of six communities that met that goal, and part of it is the 80% number worked. In 2011, the Met Council decreased that percentage to the 60% that they talked about here today. The 60% number doesn't work for the city of Woodbury. So I guess our concern is that we understand the Met Council is recommending that methodology stay the same, and I believe that Mr. Peterson said that that isn't changing, that the numbers might. So I guess that's a concern we have. The point I'd like to make, and I don't know who asked the question, but the 60% number does conflict with the federal housing policy, which uses the 80%. And just for an example, in 2011, Woodbury used our HRA funds to and our CGB dollars to help five residents who were either first-time home buyers or what we have foreclosure prevention purchase program that we operate. And so we were able to help five households who qualified under the HUD regulations, but only one of them had incomes less than 60%, so would have qualified in the affordable housing. In addition to the methodology, we do have some concerns over the numbers in the 2011-2010 housing goals. The numbers, as I think they stated, were the product of a 2006 policy. And I think we all know that the housing market has transformed dramatically since 2006. And again, I think Carl came on staff in 2008, and we started expressing our concern in 2009 with maybe those numbers weren't matching up as we see the economy take the downturn, as the foreclosure crisis came upon us, and as the values of homes just dropped precipitously.
So, Mayor, if I can interrupt.
Yes.
What is the consequences if you don't come to agreement on these numbers and you don't meet those new goals?
You know, my understanding is that the consequence is that that is one factor in a calculation used for I guess grants in all areas. So maybe I will turn that over to Carl for a more specific answer, if you don't mind.
No, that was fine. Can you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carl Batalden. I am the housing specialist and associate planner for the city of Woodbury. With regards to the question of what should happen given the scenario that Woodbury not meet its affordable housing goals, there is not, in fact, a punitive or a punishment action that would take place. It is my understanding that the way in which we proceed with adding affordable stock in the city does play a factor in the calculation that the Metropolitan Council uses when they are reviewing grant applications for LCDA funds. So the housing performance of the city of Woodbury is one of multiple factors that affect those grant-making decisions from the Met Council And again, those LCDA grants that Mr. Peterson talked about are not strictly limited to housing, but include things like infrastructure as well.
Thank you. So they are, did the Met Council arbitrarily change the number of units or the type of units, or what did they change in 2011?
In 2011, I think two things happened. One was the methodology, so the definition of affordable housing. So it went from the 80% of the area median income down to the 60%. I think that the second thing is just the numbers. I don't know that they changed. It's just that the numbers were created then for the time period for 2011 to 2020.
Is there anyone from the Met Council who could tell us where the 60% came from?
Mr. Chair, Guy Peterson again, Met Council, Peterson, Community Development Division. The 60% of area-wide median income was initially it was used as in a study of the states as well as the metro area, but the state of Minnesota's affordable housing needs in the early part of the decade of 2000. I think it was in 2003, but I can't say for sure it was that year. In a study called Housing Needs in Minnesota was the name of the study. And that study at that time that was led by or commissioned by Minnesota Housing and paid for by the Family Housing Fund or assisted by Family Housing Fund, set 60% of area median income as the as what they wanted to look at to determine what housing needs were in the state and the metro area. And so when we did our affordable housing needs numbers in advance of the comprehensive planning process, the plans were due on the last day of 2008, and we need to give communities 3 years of notice in advance of that. We need to generate numbers in 2005. And again, as I said earlier this afternoon, in collaboration with Minnesota Housing, Family Housing Fund, some other housing interested parties, and metro cities, we determined that we should keep that number at 60% of area median income. In the previous time period that the mayor has spoken to, there was a time beginning in 1996 when we looked at affordable housing for home ownership at 80% of median income and for rental housing at 50% of median income. But as I said, we changed that philosophy, changed on a statewide basis and our basis at the Metropolitan Council in the mid part of the decade, largely because the idea was to focus scarce public resources. Should they be looking at households at 80%? What are we really adding? Are we really providing affordable housing if we have households that are as high as 80% of area median income? And it was generally felt that that we should focus only on households up to 60% of area median income. And as I mentioned earlier, that's because the federal low-income housing tax credit program, which is the chief financing tool for affordable rental housing, as well as the fact that Minnesota Housing's the majority of its home mortgage programs and assistance that it gives to families are for households at or below 60% of median income. So we felt that that was the rationale, and that's what we used in calculating those needs for communities and sent those to communities, and they put them in their comprehensive plans that were due at the end of 2008.
Mr. Peterson, can you just use whatever number that the council decides? Is there any limiter?
Excuse me,
Can you
Chair.
Just use any number that you decide? 60%, 80, 50, whatever you think is the best?
Mr. Chair, yes, it's not prescribed in law, but we use what we would consider a best practice and agreed to by those that fund affordable housing in the state. What is the general consensus of all of those? And it's been felt that since the early part of the decade of the 2000s that 60% of median income was the high end of what we would wanted to focus our public resources
Peterson,
on.
Peterson, wouldn't like Woodbury and other cities be considered stakeholders that you would consult and try and work out some agreement with? Or
Mr. Chair, yes, and that's why we involved metro cities, and we in fact had a staff person, not Carl, from Woodbury that was part of our group that looked at these needs back in 2005.
Thank you. Senator Keeler.
Yeah, Mr. Peterson, just to follow up a little bit, so the 60% guideline that we're talking about here has really been in place since 2005?
Mr. Chair, Peterson. Senator, it's really been in place earlier than that, but we put it as what, when, as I said earlier in my presentation, we're to give direction to communities and guidance in the preparation of their comp plans. So we did that in 2005 using the 60% as the benchmark, the high end of the level of income that we were asking communities to address affordable housing needs at.
Woodbury, any additional comments?
Earl had one, and then I'd like to make one.
Thank you. Mr. Batalden.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can understand why the Met Council, from a metropolitan, from a regional perspective, wants to look at that 60% of area median income. However, by tying that 60% to the low-income housing tax credit tool, which is admittedly the chief tool for affordable housing production, that is, in fact, tying affordable housing to affordable rental, because the low-income housing tax credit doesn't work for ownership. It's a rental product. And for suburban communities like Woodbury that chiefly offer ownership product and ownership housing stock, there's a little bit of a contrast there. And what I just would like to emphasize in that shift from using the 80% of area median income to using the 60% of area median income. In 2010, a house was viewed as affordable if it sold for $233,100 or less. In 2011, with the shift down to 60% of AMI, that dropped by about $70,000 to the $160,000 range. And what we see in Woodbury is that the developers, you know, who are coming in based on their own market rate calculations, do not sell new or additional homes for 160 or below. And that is our concern, is that this shift from the 80% of AMI down to the 60% of AMI sort of prices us under the market, and we simply do not have the ability to meet those affordable housing goals. Whereas, as Mayor Stevens mentioned, when we've been using our federal community development block grant resources, we have been funding purchasers of first-time home buyers and our foreclosure purchase program at that 80% of AMI level. And it would be a little awkward for me if I have to certify to the federal government that these are affordable housing products and the Met Council is saying they're not.
Thank you. Mayor Stevens.
Chair and Senators, I just wanted to add, because there seemed to be confusion as to these were developed way back in 2005, but we're saying they came in 2011. I think the data and the decision was made in 2005, but I think I'm accurate when I say they weren't applied until 2011.
That's correct.
Okay. So part of my concern is because when we look at what has happened so dramatically in the economy, and in particular the housing economy and foreclosure, between the time that was determined that would be applied to the 2011 and 2020, it was so dramatic that I feel it really is kind of time to step back and say, is that 60% that we decided in 2005, is that really valid today? And what I heard was the recommendation is they're going to keep it there, and maybe I'm just asking, maybe it should be reexamined and there should be discussion on that, and it might not be the valid number today.
Mr. Chair, could I just add, this is probably the good news part of this is that we're just at the beginning of our process to reassess what these needs are, and we have an opportunity to talk about the issue of changing the AMI that we might use. So I didn't mean to create an impression that we're not, you know, we're at the beginning of the process that started it with these goals that we've negotiated. That doesn't mean we aren't going to be changing in our assessment of housing needs and then relook at the goals here as soon as we're through that process of doing the goals. So reassessing the need, I mean. So We're only at the front end of a process to look at should we revise and change the way we count units as affordable, and we welcome the participation, and we have every intent to involve metro cities and city government, again, as we have done in the past, in making these determinations.
Mr. Peterson, it does look like, though, you applied it when the market had changed dramatically in 2011 is when you decided to actually implement the requirement, and based on studies done in 2005 and after considerable dramatic changes.
Mr. Chair, there's no question that we could not see in 2005 when we were determining these needs, because, again, I tell you, we have to have 3-year lead time. We need to give communities 3 years lead time in preparing their comprehensive plans. We could not see in 2005 what changes would befall us in that time frame. And that's why we do need to reexamine these need numbers, and we will be doing that and move forward.
I'm just curious why you'd implement a number after you knew that you were going to start a process of revision. But anyway.
Well, Mr. Chair, those are the numbers that are in the local comprehensive plans. Those have been agreed to, and so we'll be using those numbers as we move through a process here to revise them.
Thank you. Any other additional comments?
I had a few before I move on, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Senators, I would
Mayor
just
Stevens, go ahead.
Like to thank Mr. Peterson for that clarification. I apologize. I thought your testimony was in the information I had received before I came here today, that while the forecast would be looked at and a new policy would be developed, I was under the impression that the 60% AMI was going to be recommended and there wouldn't be change there. So I'm very encouraged
I think there's room for change.
That they will be looking at that and there's room for change there. Just two other quick things. One is, as I stated, I think the numbers themselves we have questioned, and we stated so in our comprehensive plan back in 2008, 2009, as we were doing it, that was adopted by and accepted by the Met Council. And we just said really, because of the dramatic slowdown in residential construction, increase in mortgage foreclosures, and related issues, it really made it impractical for Woodbury to commit to the specific numbers for the 2011-2020 goals in the comprehensive plan. We also stated that we were very firm in our resistance to the suggestion that 2,057 new or additional units of affordable housing will be created in Woodbury in that time period. Given the current market condition, the City of Woodbury would hope that the Metropolitan Council would reexamine its growth projections and that we would get a lower, more realistic projection for future growth.
Thank you. Continue.
The final point I just want to make is I just want to touch on, we mentioned the letter to the Council, and then I'll say what we asked of the Met Council in our letter, but just really Woodbury's future development. The geographic and demographic conditions in the areas planned for the development of Woodbury in the coming decade really do present challenges to us in affordable housing. We are now, in terms of our growth, we are going to be developing further east and further south in our community, and really further from transportation corridors and job centers that affordable housing needs really to succeed. And so if you look at Woodbury's growth plans, we've already made movement in that area. We just invested in a sewer. Our plans to grow are south and east, further away from those corridors. So just in sum, what we sent Met Council the letter, and what we asked for was really to go back to using the 80% AMI discussion that we just had, really asking them to come up with new housing targets that reflect the slowdown in the economy and the current state of the housing market. We also suggested, somebody was talking about it earlier, that the new number include existing home stock that might now be available and be considered affordable housing. When you look in the drop of values of homes, I believe that some of that stock could now come in within the definition of affordable housing. We asked them to please include us in the process as they look at their housing language as part of their system statements. And then finally, that they would allow communities like Woodbury, who use HRA and other local dollars to communities, to also count those towards our goals for affordable housing. Thank you for the opportunity to come here today. And if you have any other questions, we'd be happy to address them.
Thank you for being here. Mr. Peterson, that is a good question that occurred to me. Is there a way that a city could move or local government could move existing stock into the affordable classification and get credit for that with the foreclosures and everything the way they are. Have you considered that?
Mr. Chair, I think what's been highlighted here today is that we have had a significant – when I was telling Senator Kelash that we used affordable housing as one of the factors, the existing amount of affordable housing as one of the factors, of course, we were looking at the situation as it existed in 2005. And as the mayor has indicated, there has been significant changes in the affordability of housing. It would change that factor considerably for every community. So, yes, we do need to be reexamining our numbers and changing based upon what the reality is right now in terms of housing affordability in communities.
Okay, thank you so much for coming, Mr. Peterson, Mr. Shetland, Met Council, and Mayor, and Mr. Bitlin. Say that correctly?
That's okay. It's an obscure Norwegian island. It's hard for anybody to pronounce.
Great discussion. Thank you all for your time. Thank you, members. We will adjourn now.